From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Cross of Lorraine by Isaac Asimov. Immanuel Rubin did not, as a general rule, ever permit a look of relief to cross his face. Had one done so, it would have argued a prior feeling of uncertainty or apprehension, sensations he might feel but would certainly never admit to. This time, however, the relief was unmistakable. It was monthly banquet time for the Black Widowers. Rubin was the host, and it was he who was supplying the guest. And here it was 20 minutes after 7, and only now, but with 10 minutes left before dinner was to start, only now did his guest arrive. Reuben bounded toward him, careful, however, not to spill a drop of his second drink. "Gentlemen," he said, clutching the arm of the newcomer, "my guest, the amazing Larry," spelled L-A-R-R-I, and in a lowered voice over the hum of "pleased to meet yous." "Where the hell were you?" Larry muttered. The subway train stalled. Then he returned smiles and greetings. "Pardon me," said Henry, the perennial and nonpareil waiter at the Black Widower banquets, "but there is not much time for the guest to have his drink before dinner begins. Would you state your preference, sir?" "A good notion, that," said Larry gratefully. "Thank you, waiter. And let me have a dry martini, but not too darn dry, a little damp, so to speak." "Certainly, sir," said Henry. Reuben said, "I've told you, Larry, that we members all have our ex officio doctorates, so now let me introduce them in nauseating detail. This tall gentleman with a neat mustache, black eyebrows, and straight back is Dr. Jeffrey Avalon. He's a lawyer, and he never smiles. The last time he tried, he was fined for contempt of court." Avalon smiled as broadly as he could and said, "You undoubtedly know Manny well enough, sir, not to take him seriously." "Undoubtedly," said Larry. As he and Rubens did before, they looked remarkably alike. Both were the same height, about 5'5". Both had active, inquisitive faces. Both had straggly beards, though Larry's was longer and was accompanied by a fringe of hair down both sides of his face as well. Rubens said, "And here, dressed fit to kill anyone with a real taste for clothing, is our artist expert, Dr. Mario Gonzalo, who will insist on producing a caricature of you in which he will claim to see a resemblance. Dr. Roger Halstead inflicts pain on junior high school students under the guise of teaching them what little he knows of mathematics. Dr. James Drake is a superannuated chemist who once conned someone into granting him a PhD. And finally, Dr. Thomas Trumbull, who works for the government in an unnamed job as a code expert and who spends most of his time hoping Congress doesn't find out." "Manny," said Trumbull wearily, "if it were possible to cast a retroactive blackball, I think you could count on 5. And Henry said, "Gentlemen, dinner is served." It was one of those rare Black Widower occasions when lobster was served, rarer now than ever because of the increase in price. Reuben, who as host bore the cost, shrugged it off. "I made a good paperback sale last month, and we can call this a celebration." "We can celebrate," said Avalon, "but lobster tends to kill conversation. The cracking of claws and shells, the extraction of meat, the dipping of melted butter, all that takes one's full of concentration." And he grimaced with the effort he was putting into the compression of a nutcracker. "In that case," said the amazing Larry, "I shall have a monopoly of the conversation," and he grinned with satisfaction as a large platter of prime rib roast was dexterously placed before him by Henry. "Larry's allergic to seafood," said Reuben. Conversation was indeed subdued, as Avalon had predicted, until the various lobsters had been clearly worsted in culinary battle, and then finally Halsted asked, "What makes you Amazing Larry?"
"Stage name," said Larry. "I'm a prestidigitator, an escapist extraordinary, and the greatest living exposer." Trumbull, who was sitting to Larry's right, formed ridges on his bronze forehead. "What the devil do you mean by exposer?"
Reuben beat a tattoo on his water glass at this point and said, "No grilling till we've had our coffee."
"For God's sake," said Trumbull. "I'm just asking for the definition of a word."
"Host's decision is final," said Reuben. Trumbull scowled in Reuben's direction.
"Then I'll guess the answer. An exposer is one who exposes fakes. People who, using trickery of one sort or another, pretend to produce effects that they attribute to supernatural or paranatural forces."
Larry thrust out his lower lip, raised his eyebrows, and nodded.
"Very good for a guess. I couldn't have put it better." Gonzalez said, "You mean that whatever someone did by what he claimed was real magic, you could do by stage magic?"
"Exactly," said Larry. "For instance, suppose that some mystic claimed he had the capacity to bend spoons by means of unknown forces. I can do the same by using natural force, this way." He lifted a spoon and, holding it by two ends, he bent it half an inch out of shape.
Trumbull said, "That scarcely counts. Anyone can do it that way."
"Ah," said Larry, "but this spoon you saw me bend is not the amazing effect at all. That spoon you were watching merely served to trap and focus the ethereal rays that did the real work. Those rays acted to bend your spoon, Dr. Trumbull."
Trumbull looked down and picked up his spoon, which was bent nearly at right angles.
"How did you do this?"
Larry shrugged.
"Would you believe ethereal forces?"
Drake laughed, and pushing his dismantled lobster toward the center of his table, lit a cigarette. He said, "Larry did it a few minutes ago with his hands, when you weren't looking."
Larry seemed unperturbed by exposure.
"When Manny banged his glass, Dr. Trumbull, you looked away. I had rather hoped you all would."
Drake said, "I know better than to pay attention to Manny."
"But," said Larry, "if no one had seen me do it, would you have accepted the ethereal forces?"
"Not a chance," said Trumbull.
"Even if there had been no other way in which you could explain the effect. Here, let me show you something. Suppose you wanted to flip a coin."
He fell silent for a moment while Henry passed out the strawberry shortcake, pushed his own serving out of the way, and said, "Suppose you wanted to flip a coin without actually lifting it and turning it. This penny, for instance. There are a number of ways it could be done. The simplest would be merely to touch it quickly, because, as you all know, a finger is always slightly sticky, especially at mealtime, so that the coin lifts up slightly as the finger is removed and can easily be made to flip over. It is tails now, you see. Touch it again, and it is heads."
Gonzalez said, "No prestidigitation there, though. We saw it flip."
"Exactly," said Larry, "and that's why I won't do it that way. Let's put something over it so that it can't be touched. Suppose we use a..." He looked around the table for a moment and seized a salt shaker.
"Suppose we use this."
He placed the salt shaker over the coin and said, "Now it's a showing heads."
"Hold on," said Gonzalo. "How do we know it's showing heads? It could be tails, and then when you reveal it later, you'll say it flipped, when it was tails all along."
"You're perfectly right," said Larry, "and I'm glad you raised the point. Dr. Drake, you have eyes that caught me before. Would you check this on behalf of the assembled company? I'll lift a salt shaker and you tell me what the coin shows."
Drake looked and said, "Heads," in his softly hoarse voice.
"You'll all take Dr. Drake's word, I hope, gentlemen. Please watch me place the salt shaker back on the coin and make sure it doesn't flip in the process."
"It didn't," said Drake. "Now, to keep my fingers from slipping while performing this trick, I will put this paper napkin over the salt shaker."
Larry folded the paper napkin neatly and carefully around the salt shaker, then said, "But, in manipulating this napkin, I caused you all to divert your attention from the penny, and you may think I have flipped in the process."
He lifted the salt shaker with a napkin around it and said, "Dr. Drake, will you check the coin again?" Drake leaned toward it. "Still heads," he said. Very carefully and gently, Larry put back the salt shaker, the paper napkin still folded around it, and said, "The coin remained as is?" "Still heads," said Drake. "In that case, I now perform the magic." Larry pushed down on the salt shaker, and the paper napkin collapsed. There was nothing inside. There was a moment of shock, and then Gonzalo said, "Where's the salt shaker?" "In another plane of existence," said Larry airily. "But you said you were going to flip the coin." "I lied." Avalon said, "There is no mystery. He had us all concentrating on the coin as a diversion tactic. When he picked up the salt shaker with a napkin around it to let Jim look at the coin, he just dropped the salt shaker into his hand and placed the empty folded napkin over the coin." "Did you see me do that, Dr. Avalon?" asked Larry. "No, I was looking at the coin too." "Then you're just guessing," said Larry. Reuben, who had not participated in the demonstration at all, but who had eaten his strawberry shortcake instead, said, "The tendency is to argue these things out logically, and that's impossible. Scientists and other rationalists are used to dealing with a universe which fights fair. Faced with a mystic who does not, they find themselves maneuvered into believing nonsense and, in the end, making fools of themselves." "Magicians, on the other hand," Reuben went on, "know what to watch for, are experienced enough not to be misdirected, and are not impressed by the apparently supernatural. That's why mystics generally won't perform if they know magicians are in the audience." Coffee had been served and was being sipped, and Henry was quietly preparing the brandy when Reuben sounded the water glass and said, "Gentlemen, it is time for the official grilling, assuming you idiots have left anything to grill. Jeff, will you do the honors tonight?" Avalon cleared his throat portentously and frowned down on the amazing Larry from under his dark and luxuriant eyebrows. Using his voice in the deepest of its naturally deep register, he said, "It is customary to ask our guests to justify their existences. But if today's guest exposes phony mystics even occasionally, I for one consider his existence justified and will pass on to another question. The temptation is to ask you how you performed your little disappearing trick of a few moments ago, but I quite understand that the ethics of your profession preclude your telling us, even though everything said here is considered under the rose, and though nothing has ever leaked. I will refrain from that question. Let me instead ask about your failures, sir. You describe yourself as an exposer. Have there been any supposedly mystical demonstrations you have not been able to account for by natural means?" Larry said, "I have not attempted to explain all the effects I have ever encountered or heard of, but where I have studied an effect and made an attempt to duplicate it, I have succeeded in every case." "No failures?" "None." Avalon considered that, but as he prepared for the next question, Gonzalo broke in. His head was leaning on one palm, but the fingers of that hand were carefully disposed in such a way as to not disarray his hair. He said, "Now wait. Larry, would it be right to suggest that you tackled only easy cases, the really puzzling cases you might have made no attempts to explain?" "You mean," said Larry, "that I shied away from anything that might spoil my perfect record, or that might upset my belief in the rational order of the universe?" "If so, you're quite wrong, Dr. Gonzalo. Most reports of apparent mystical powers are dull and unimportant, crude and patently false. I ignore those. The cases I do take on are precisely the puzzling ones that have attracted attention because of their unusual nature and their apparent divorce from the rational. So you see, the ones I take on are precisely those you suspect I avoid." Gonzalo subsided and Avalon said, "Larry, the mere fact that you can duplicate a trick by prestidigitation doesn't mean that it couldn't also have been performed by a mystic through supernatural means. The fact that human beings can build machines that fly doesn't mean that birds are man-made machines." "Quite right," said Larry, "but mystics lay their claims to supernatural powers on the notion, either expressed or implicit, that there is no other way of producing the effect. If I show that the same effect can be produced by natural means, the burden of proof then shifts to them to show that the effect can be produced after the natural means are made impossible. I don't know of any mystic who has accepted the conditions set by professional magicians to guard against trickery, and who then succeeded. And nothing has ever baffled you? Not even the tricks other magicians have developed? Oh, yes. There are effects produced by some magicians that baffle me in the sense that I don't know quite how they do it. I might duplicate the effect by perhaps using a different method. In any case, that's not the point. As long as an effect is produced by natural means, it doesn't matter whether I can reproduce it or not. I'm not the best magician in the world. I'm just a better magician than any mystic is. Halsted, his high forehead flushed and stuttering slightly in his eagerness to speak, said, "But then nothing would startle you. No disappearance like the one involving the salt shaker."
"You mean that one?" asked Lori, pointing.
There was a salt shaker in the middle of the table, but no one had seen it placed there. Halsted, thrown off a moment, recovered and said, "Have you ever been startled by any disappearance? I heard once that magicians have made elephants disappear." "Actually, making an elephant disappear is childishly simple. I assure you there's nothing puzzling about disappearances performed in a magic act." And then a peculiar look crossed Larry's face, a flash of sadness and frustration. "Not in a magic act, just..."
"Yes," said Halsted, "just what?"
"Just in real life," said Larry, smiling and attempted to toss off the remark lightheartedly.
"Just a minute," said Trumbull. "We can't let that pass.
If there has been a disappearance in real life, you can't explain. We want to hear about it."
Larry shook his head. "No, no, Dr. Trumbull, it is not a mysterious disappearance or an inexplicable one. Nothing like that at all. I lost something and can't find it, and it saddens me."
"The details," said Trumbull.
"It wouldn't be worth your attention," said Larry, embarrassed.
"It's a silly story and somewhat..." He fell into silence.
"Damn it," thundered Trumbull. "We all sit here and voluntarily refrain from asking anything that might result in your being tempted to violate your ethics. Would it violate the ethics of the magician's art for you to tell this story?"
"It's not that at all."
"Well then, sir, I repeat. What Jeff has told you, everything said here, is an absolute confidence. And the agreement surrounding these monthly dinners is that all questions must be answered."
"Manny?"
Reuben shrugged.
"That's the way it is, Larry. If you don't want to answer the question, we'll have to declare the meeting at an end."
Larry sat back in his chair and looked depressed.
"I can't very well allow that to happen, considering the time hospitality I've been shown. I will tell you the story, but you'll find there's not much to it. I met a woman quite accidentally. I lost touch with her. I can't locate her. That's all there is."
"No," said Trumbull. "That's not all there is. Where and how did you meet her? Where and how did you lose touch with her? Why can't you find her again? We want to know the details."
Gonzalo said, "In fact, if you tell us the details, we may be able to help you."
Larry laughed sardonically. "I think not."
"You'd be surprised," said Gonzalo. "In the past,"
Avalon said.
"Quiet, Mario. Don't make promises we might not be able to keep. Would you give us the details, sir? I assure you we'll do our best to help."
Larry smiled wearily.
"I appreciate your offer, but you will see that there is nothing you can do merely by sitting here." He adjusted himself in his seat and said, "I was done with my performance in an upstate town. I'll give you the details when and if you insist, but for the moment they don't matter, except that this happened about a month ago. I had to get to another small town some 150 miles away for a morning show, and that presented a little transportation problem. My magic, unfortunately, is not the kind that can transport me 150 miles in a twinkling or even conjure up a pair of 7-league boots. I did not have my car with me. Just as well, for I don't like to travel strange roads at night when I am sleepy. and the net result was that I would have had to take a bus that would take nearly 4 hours. I planned to catch some sleep while on wheels and thus make the trip serve a double purpose. But when things go wrong, they go wrong in battalions. So you can guess that I missed my bus and that the next one would not come along for 2 more hours. There was an enclosed station which I could wait, one that was as dreary as you could imagine, with no reading matter except some fly-blown posters on the wall. No place to buy a paper or a cup of coffee. I thought grimly that it was fortunate it wasn't raining, and settled down to drowse. But my luck changed. A woman walked in. I've never been married, gentlemen, and I've never even had what young people call today a meaningful relationship. Some casual attachments, perhaps, but on the whole, though, it seems trite to say so. I am married to my art and find it much more satisfying than women, generally. I had no reason to think that this woman was an improvement on the generality, but she had a pleasant appearance. She was something over 30 and was just plump enough to have a warm, comfortable look about her, and she wasn't too tall. She looked about and said, smiling, "Well, I've missed my bus, I see." I smiled with her. I liked the way she said it. She didn't fret or whine or act annoyed at the universe. It was a good-humored statement of fact, and just hearing it cheered me up tremendously, because actually I myself was in the mood to fret and whine and act annoyed. Now, I could be as good-natured as she and said, "Two of us, madam, so you don't even have the satisfaction of being unique." "So much the better," she said. "We can talk and pass the time that much faster." I was astonished. She did not treat me as a potential attacker or as a possible thief. God knows I am not handsome or even particularly respectable in appearance, but it was as though she had casually penetrated to my inmost character and found it satisfactory. You have no idea how flattered I was. If I were 10 times as sleepy, I would have stayed up to talk to her. And we did talk.
Instead of 15 minutes, I knew I was having the pleasantest conversation in my life. In a crummy bus station at midnight, I can't tell you all we talked about, but I can tell you what we didn't talk about. We didn't talk about magic. I can interest anyone by doing tricks, but then it isn't me they're interested in. It's the flying fingers and the patter they like, and while I'm willing to buy attention that way, you don't know how pleasant it is to get the attention without purchasing it. She apparently just liked to listen to me, and I know I like to listen to her. Fortunately, my trip was not an all-out effort, so I didn't have my large trunk with the show business advertising all over it, just 2 rather large valises. I told her nothing personal about myself and asked nothing about her. I gathered briefly that she was heading for her brother's place, that it was right on the road, that she would have to wake him up because she had carelessly let herself be late, but she only told me that in order to say that she was glad it had happened. She would buy my company at the price of inconveniencing her brother. I liked that. We didn't talk politics or world affairs or religion or the theater. We talked people, all the funny and odd and peculiar things we had observed about people. We laughed for 2 hours, during which not one other person came to join us. I had never had anything like that happen to me. I had never felt so alive and happy. And when the bus finally came at 1:50 a.m., it was amazing how sorry I was. I didn't want the night to end. When we got onto the bus, of course, it was no longer quite the same thing, even though we found a double seat we could share. After all, we had been alone in the station, and there we could talk loudly and laugh. On the bus, people were sleeping. Of course, it wasn't all bad. It was a nice feeling to have her so close to me, despite the fact that I'm rather an old horse. I felt like a teenager, enough like a teenager, in fact, to be embarrassed at being watched. Immediately across the way was a woman and her young son. He was about 8 years old, I should judge, and he was awake. He kept watching me with his sharp little eyes. I could see those eyes fixed on us every time a street light shone onto the bus, and it was very inhibiting. I wish he were asleep, but of course the excitement of being on a bus perhaps was keeping him awake. The motion of the bus, the occasional whisper, the feeling of being quite out of reality, the pressure of her body against mine, it was like confusing dreams and fact.
and the boundary between sleep and wakefulness just vanished. I didn't intend to sleep, and I started awake once or twice, but then finally, when I started awake one more time, it was clear there had been a considerable period of sleep, and the seat next to me was empty. Halstead said, "I take it she had gotten off?" "I didn't think she had disappeared into thin air," said Larry. "Naturally, I looked about. I couldn't call her name because I didn't know her name. She wasn't in the restroom because its door was swinging open." The little boy across the aisle spoke in a rapid, high treble. In French. I can understand French reasonably well, but I didn't have to make any effort because his mother was now awakened and she translated. She spoke English quite well. She said, "Pardon me, sir, but is it that you are looking for the woman that was with you?" "Yes," I said. "Did you see where she got off?" "Not I, sir. I was sleeping, but my son says that she descended at the place of the Cross of Lorraine."
"At the what?"
She repeated it, and so did the boy, in French. She said, "You must excuse my son, sir. He is a great hero worshipper of President Charles de Gaulle, and though he is young, he knows the tale of the free French forces in the war very well. He would not miss a sight like a Cross of Lorraine. If he said he saw it, he did." I thanked them and then went forward to the bus driver and asked him. But at that time of night, the bus stops wherever a passenger would like to get off or get on. He had made numerous stops and let numerous people on and off, and he didn't know for sure where he had stopped and whom he had let off. He was rather churlish, in fact. Avalon cleared his throat. "He may have thought you were up to no good and was deliberately withholding information to protect the passenger." "Maybe," said Larry despondently, "but what it amounts to was that I had lost her. When I came back to my seat, I found a little note tucked into the pocket of the jacket I had placed at the rack above. I managed to read it by street light at the next stop, where the French mother and son got off. It said, 'Thank you so much for a delightful time, Gwendolyn.'" Gonzalo said, "You have her first name anyway." Larry said, "I would appreciate having her last name, her address, her telephone number. A first name is useless." "You know," said Reuben, "she may deliberately have withheld information because she wasn't interested in continuing the acquaintanceship. A romantic little interlude is one thing. A continuing danger is another. She may be a married woman." "Have you done anything about trying to find her?" asked Gonzalo. "Certainly," said Larry sardonically. "If a magician is faced with a disappearing woman, he must understand what has happened. I have gone over the bus route twice by car, looking for a Cross of Lorraine. If I found it, I would have gone in and asked if anyone there knew a woman by the name of Gwendolyn. I'd have described her. I've gone to the local post office or the local police station." "But you haven't found a Cross of Lorraine, I take it," said Trumbull. "I have not." Halstead said, "Mathematically speaking, it's a finite problem. You could try every post office along the whole route." Larry sighed. "If I get desperate enough, I'll try. But mathematically speaking, that would be so inelegant. Why can't I find the Cross of Lorraine?" "The youngster might have made a mistake," said Trumbull. "Not a chance," said Larry. "An adult, yes, but a child, never. Adults have accumulated enough irrationality to be very unreliable eyewitnesses. A bright 8-year-old is different. Don't try to pull any trick on a bright kid. He'll see through it." "Just the same," he went on, "nowhere on the route is there a restaurant, a department store, or anything else with the name Cross of Lorraine. I've checked every set of yellow pages along the entire route." "Now wait a while," said Avalon. "That's wrong. The child would have seen the words because they would have meant nothing to him. If he spoke and read only French, as I suppose he did, he would know the phrase as Croix de Lorraine. The English would have never caught his eye. He must have seen the symbol, the cross with the two horizontal bars like this." He reached out, and Henry obligingly handed him a menu. Avalon turned it over and on the blank back drew the cross the way he described. "Actually," he said, "it's more properly called the Patriarchal Cross or the Archiepiscopal Cross, since it symbolized the high office of patriarchs and archbishops by doubling the bars. You will not be surprised to hear that the Papal Cross has 3 bars. The patriarchal cross was used as a symbol of Godfrey of Bouillon, who was one of the leaders of the First Crusade, and since he was Duke of Lorraine, it came to be called the Cross of Lorraine. As we all know, it was adopted as the emblem of the Free French during the Hitlerian War. He coughed slightly and tried to look modest. Larry said a little impatiently, I understand about the symbol, Dr. Avalon, and I didn't expect the youngster to know words. I think you'll agree, though, that any establishment calling itself the Cross of Lorraine would surely display the symbol along with the name. I looked for the name in the yellow pages and for the symbol on the road. And you didn't find it, said Gonzalo. As I've already said, I didn't. I was desperate enough to consider things I didn't think the kid could possibly have seen at night. I thought, who knows how sharp young eyes are and how readily they may see something that represents an overriding interest. So I looked at signs and windows, at street signs, even at graffiti. If it were a graffito, said Trumbull, which happens to be the singular form of graffiti, by the way, then of course, it would have been erased between the time the child saw it and the time you came to look for it. I'm not sure of that, said Reuben. It's my experience that graffiti are never erased. We've got some on the outside of our apartment house. That's New York, said Trumbull, and smaller towns. There's less tolerance for these evidences of anarchy. Hold on, said Gonzalo. What makes you think graffiti are necessarily signs of anarchy? As a matter of fact, gentlemen, gentlemen, and as always, when Avalon's voice was raised to its full baritone, a silence fell. We are not here to argue the merits and demerits of graffiti. The question is, how can we find this woman who disappeared? Larry has found no restaurant or other establishment with the name of Cross of Lorraine. He has found no evidence of the symbol along the route then. Can we help him? Drake held up his hand and squinted through the curling smoke of his cigarette. Hold on, there's no problem. Have you ever seen a Russian Orthodox church? Do you know what its cross is like? He made quick marks on the back of the menu and shoved it toward the center of the table. Here, he said. The kid, being hipped on the Free French, would take a quick look at that and see it as the Cross of Lorraine. So what you have to do, Larry, is look for a Russian Orthodox church en route. I doubt there would be more than one. Larry thought about it but did not seem overjoyed. The cross with that second bar set at an angle would be on the top of the spire, wouldn't it? I imagine so. And it wouldn't be floodlit, would it? How would the child be able to see it at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning? Drake stubbed out a cigarette. Well now, churches usually have a bulletin board near the entrance. There could have been a Russian Orthodox cross on the... I would have seen it, said Larry firmly. Could it have been a Red Cross, said Gonzalo feebly. You know, there might be a Red Cross headquarters along the route. The Red Cross, said Reuben, is a Greek cross with all four arms equal. I don't see how that could possibly be mistaken for a Cross of Lorraine by a Free French enthusiast. Look at it. Halstead said, the logical thing, I suppose, is that you simply missed it, Larry. If you insist that as a magician you're such a trained observer that you couldn't have missed it, then maybe it was a symbol on something movable, on a truck, in a driveway, for instance, and it moved on after sunrise. The boy made it quite clear that it was at the place of the Cross of Lorraine, said Larry. I suppose even an 8-year-old can tell the difference between a place and a movable object. He spoke French. Maybe you misunderstood. I'm not that bad at the language, said Larry, and besides, his mother translated in French is her native tongue. But English isn't. She might have gotten it wrong. The kid might have said something else. He might not even have said the Cross of Lorraine at all. Avalon raised his hand for silence and said, One moment, gentlemen. I see Henry, our esteemed waiter, smiling. What is it, Henry? Henry, from his place at the sideboard, said, I'm afraid that I'm amused at your doubting the child's evidence. It is quite certain, in my opinion, that he did see the Cross of Lorraine. There was a moment's silence, and Larry said, How can you tell us that, Henry? By not being too subtle, sir. Avalon's voice boomed out. I knew it. We're being too complicated. Henry, how is it possible for us to achieve greater simplicity? Why, Mr. Avalon, the incident took place at night. Instead of looking at all signs, all places, all varieties of cross, why not begin by asking ourselves what very few things can be easily seen on a highway at night?
A cross of Lorraine? Asked Gonzalo incredulously.
Certainly, said Henry, among other things, especially if we don't call it a cross of Lorraine.
What the youngster saw as a cross of Lorraine, out of his special interest, we would see as something else so clearly that its relationship to the cross of Lorraine would be invisible. What has been happening just now has been precisely what happened earlier with Mr. Larry's trick with the coin in the salt shaker. We concentrated on the coin and didn't watch the salt shaker. And now we concentrate on the cross of Lorraine and don't look for the alternative.
Trumbull said, Henry, if you don't stop talking in riddles, you're fired. What the hell is the cross of Lorraine if it isn't the cross of Lorraine?
Henry said gravely, what is this? And carefully he drew on the back of the menu.
Trumbull said, a cross of Lorraine, tilted.
No, sir, you could never have thought so if we hadn't been talking about the cross of Lorraine. Those are English letters and a very common symbol on highways, if you add something to it. He wrote quickly, and the tilted cross became Exxon.
The one thing, said Henry, that is designed to be seen without trouble day or night on any highway is a gas station sign. The child saw the cross of Lorraine in this one, but Mr. Larry, retracing the route, sees only a double X, since he reads the entire sign as Exxon. All signs showing this name, whether on the highway, in advertisements, or on credit cards, show the name in this fashion.
Now Larry caught fire. You mean, Henry, that if I go into the Exxon stations en route and ask for Gwendolyn? The proprietor of one of them is likely to be her brother, and there would not be more than half a dozen or so at most to inquire at.
Good God, Henry, said Larry. You're a magician.
Merely simple-minded, said Henry, though not, I hope, in the pejorative sense.